All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is the 21st of February. First order of business will be for Ms. Niedernhofer to take the role.
Chair Liebling.
Present.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
Present.
Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Representative Ackland.
Ackland present.
Representative Backer.
Backer present.
Representative Bonner. Representative Bonner. Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Bolden present.
Representative Damuth.
Damuth present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Keel. Representative Keel. Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor. Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Ryer.
Ryer present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Wolgamuth.
Present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. And I'm sure as the others get on, we'll just mark them as present when we see them. So thank you very much. So I'm going to now, the next order of business is the minutes from last week, February 16th, Representative Bolden.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes from February 16th.
All right, thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor, please say aye. Any opposed? All right, thank you. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So we today have a full agenda. And first, we're going to welcome back Commissioner Malcolm from the Department of Health so that she can finish her presentation, her long delayed presentation, completing her explanation of the governor's budget proposal in her area. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of MDH. Just a really quick regrounding of what we've already covered. There are really four categories in the governor's budget pertaining to MDH, and then an additional issue. So the four categories, the first one was healthcare access and affordability. You can see there were four proposals here really aiming at healthcare costs, making it easier for consumers to know who's in what networks, and some significant proposals around healthcare workforce. The second category was the prevention category. That was slide 7. And that one, there are 10 proposals in this prevention bucket, and they, as we discussed, they really kind of range across a number of different areas of public health concern. But that you can see there, just a reminder of the list of issues from suicide prevention to drug overdose and substance abuse to community health workers, disability, lead remediation, climate resiliency. So we covered a lot of ground in that first one. We were on the supporting families and children category. The summary of that is at slide 13. And we were into this category. So we had talked about a couple of proposals that really feature community-driven solutions to early childhood development and to recovery from COVID, really aiming, coming from and supporting the communities most disproportionately affected and suffering the greatest inequities in child outcomes. And then we talked about a very large and exciting expansion of home visiting. one of our strongest evidence-based programs to really assist with early childhood development and school readiness, preventing harm to kids by supporting parents. Then we talked briefly about the family planning special projects some of the pent-up demand that occurred during the pandemic for things like screening for sexually transmitted illnesses and other kind of wellness exams could be supported with expanded and with continued access and expanded hours in those grantee programs. So we were on the Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families proposal. And that also is an exciting package of proposals that are part of this kind of early childhood and family support big category that the governor's budget contains. So in this Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families, this too is a collaboration between a number of different agencies to really focus another way to focus on the significant disparities in early childhood outcomes and increasing the number of kids who are school ready. And here too, this proposal has a number of components in it. First of all, it establishes a Minnesota collaborative to prevent infant mortality. There is a work group in, for as part of Governor Walz's One Minnesota goals that's been working hard on infant mortality reduction strategies. And this idea comes from that. This collaborative would be a public-private partnership, really focusing on community engagement, exchange of best practices, data, improvements in accessibility. And so here we would be providing infant mortality reduction grants to communities, tribes, and local public health to improve infant outcomes. So that this is a collaborative and a grant program. The second element here allows us to continue a program that we started just a couple of years ago called Help Me Connect. This is an interagency initiative between MDH, Department of Human Services, and Department of Education, and the Governor's Children's Cabinet. Help Me Connect is a website landing page that facilitates referral and access to community-based resources, which are culturally and ethnically appropriate. The next component here provides access to voluntary developmental and social-emotional screening to identify children in need of further evaluation, support, and resources. This is for children birth to kindergarten entrance to make sure that kids are ready for school. The last component of this Healthy Beginnings proposal is to expand the JAIL model practices learning community. This is to help address adverse health impacts for children with incarcerated parents. I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people to know that parental incarceration is the number one adverse childhood experience for Minnesota's children, affecting one in six Minnesota kids. It negatively affects children's mental health, increases their risk of substance abuse, and certainly impacts their educational outcomes due in part to the disruption in the parent-child relationship. This program partners with county jails to implement evidence-based strategies, services, and supports for justice-involved families. This is something that a number of our counties under the leadership of our State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, our SHAC, has worked in partnership with the Department of Corrections to create these ideas. The next slide, and the last in this families and children category, is our school health proposal. It's undeniable that COVID-19 has not only impacted our young people's physical health, but their mental health as well, and their social, emotional learning and coping skills. And we know that school-based health centers, there's a long history over many decades that school-based health centers do increase access to care for many kids who may struggle to find that access. It improves health outcomes and it increases academic achievement for participating children. So this is another collaborative proposal with the Department of Education and would provide competitive grants to either expand health services, including dental services in existing school health programs, or it would allow some new school-based health clinics to be started up statewide as well to meet really this comprehensive set of physical, dental, mental, and behavioral health needs of K-12 students. So that is the last one in this supporting families and children. That's certainly the largest financial component of the MDH budget proposals. And moving to the next category, sustaining public health programs, there are 7 proposals in this category. And this is really about a number of programs that are just kind of core public health work, there are a number of proposals to stabilize fees, for instance. But the first one in this category, very important given what we've just been through, is the public health workforce. Just preliminary steps, certainly not a comprehensive solution, but a way to get started on rebuilding the public health workforce. State, local, and tribal health departments, certainly along with our healthcare provider colleagues, have just really borne the brunt of this pandemic in a lot of ways. And it's really hard to find and attract and retain public health workers right now. Similar to what you've heard about from the healthcare workforce, public health staff are also leaving government in record numbers to work elsewhere, often with greater pay and less pressured work, or retiring, leaving the workforce altogether, or even switching careers. And public health agencies are truly competing with other sectors in this very tight labor market that we know exists really across our economy. But our public health agencies are really struggling to find qualified staff to fill vacancies. This is true for us at the state as well, but we're particularly concerned here about local public health agencies, particularly in Greater Minnesota. So this proposal would have a number of tools to attract and retain a committed and diverse and talented public health workforce. First, we'd expand our existing loan forgiveness program to also apply to individuals working in local, tribal, or state health departments. We would provide support for a public health AmeriCorps program in Minnesota. Our colleagues at the University of Minnesota are working to stand up this AmeriCorps program, and our component here would be to increase the living stipend for public health AmeriCorps members to be equivalent to a living wage. And finally, we'd offer educational stipends for students participating in field placements in local, tribal, or the state health department. So that's the first proposal in this category. The next one funds safety improvements in long-term care facilities. And we have certainly learned a great deal these last 2 years of the pandemic, and it's been difficult learning. It's come at great cost. To learn about how buildings themselves, the physical structures of the long-term care system, can contribute to reducing transmission of infectious diseases or helping to fuel the spread, especially a disease as easily transmissible as COVID-19. 50,000 Minnesotans live in facilities that are licensed by the state, in long-term care facilities licensed by Minnesota state government. Many of these long-term care facilities were built in the 1960s or earlier and definitely need updates to their physical environments to improve infection control and improve the daily lives of their residents. This proposal would establish a temporary competitive grant program for these facilities to make physical improvements or investments in communications technology to address social isolation and other modifications to increase safety, quality of care, and well-being of residents as well as staff. These could include projects to improve heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems, or to the physical layout of the space, or to technology improvements. So a flexible source of funding for facilities to make some of the improvements that have become so clear in their need. The next three proposals on the next slide help to sustain public health programs through the fee mechanism. So this first proposal addresses assisted living and home care licensure. This is really a success story. In the last year, over 2,000 facilities received an assisted living license last year. This was greater than our projections of the number of home care providers that would convert to assisted living licenses. So that this was about 20% more assisted living licenses than we were expecting and projecting. As well, a number of assisted living providers did choose to retain their home care license instead of allowing it to expire or replacing it with a new assisted living licensure. So there's 2,000 facilities that became licensed as assisted living, and there are currently over 1,700 home care registrations. And the higher number of both of these types of license and registration than we were projecting means that we need to hire additional staff to meet the increased workload and to make sure that we can enforce all the health and safety requirements with both of both assisted living licensure and home care registration to make sure that we're doing that and doing that consistent with the timelines established in statute. So this is not a fee increase, but rather an increase in the appropriation to MDH to carry out our responsibilities. This next proposal is another fee proposal related to long-term care facility and hospital oversight. And this would be a slight increase in licensing fees. This is about engineering plan review specifically, and this proposal really right-sizes the fees to better reflect both the demand for engineering plan reviews and the complexity of facility expansion and modernization of both nursing homes and hospitals to make sure that the fees are able to costs here. And the last item on this slide is a fee and appropriation adjustment, so both increase to fees and increase to appropriation for the state trauma system. This is really, our state's trauma system is really a point of pride for our healthcare system. This would modestly increase hospital license fees and align the appropriations from the general fund and the state government special revenue fund that we use to designate trauma hospitals and ensure an effective statewide trauma system. When the trauma system was first established, we anticipated that a modest number of hospitals would seek trauma designation. There are four levels of trauma services, as you may be aware. But in fact, a very large number of hospitals in Minnesota have chosen to receive trauma designation at one level or another. So this would this proposal assures that we are able to continue to keep up with trauma designation as those standards continue to evolve and ensure that we've got a coordinated infrastructure that's able to support our communities by providing 24/7 trauma and disaster care locally, regionally, and statewide. And that is it for that slide. Then the next slide, the final two proposals in this public health programs section. The first is a minor adjustment to better support the administrative costs for our medical education and research cost, or MERC, program. $150,000 proposal from the existing general fund appropriation for MERC grants to support the management of the program. And the second proposal on this slide, the final one in this category, is to reinstate our Drinking Water and Wastewater Advisory Council. This will not have a fiscal impact. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act calls for best practices to have an annual review by an external entity of the state's certification program for certifying operators of drinking water programs. This council has lapsed. This would allow us to reinstate the council, which is an important way to identify and address stakeholder concerns in water supply system and wastewater treatment facilities, operator training and certification. This does not need an appropriation adjustment because even though the council sunset, the appropriation to support the council did not sunset. So we have the resources to support this council. And then finally, one last proposal that didn't really fit any of the other categories. And this is the governor's proposal for legalizing adult use cannabis. As you may know, the governor's budget recommends establishing a new cannabis management office, which would not be part of MDH, but it would be responsible for the implementation of the regulatory framework for adult use cannabis. This proposal does envision moving the MDH Office of Medical Cannabis into this new cannabis management office. So this proposal, it transfers some functions to the new office outside of MDH, but does contain funding for ongoing public health functions related to legalizing adult use cannabis. This would include, as we do with many other issues, data collection and monitoring on cannabis use rates in Minnesota, youth cannabis use prevention programming, and education for pregnant and breastfeeding women about the health effects of cannabis use during pregnancy. And these provisions would provide important public health protections for consumer education and safety in a new adult use framework. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the extra time to complete the budget review. I know we didn't have a lot of time for questions last time. I also know you've got a full agenda, so I'm happy to answer any questions now. I know we're going to be talking about a number of these things in greater detail as you move along. So I'm at your service.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner, for that. And sorry to have to break up your presentation the way we did. But I think that we will move on now because we are going to be looking at a lot of the things in your budget separately with different topics, as obviously it covers a wide range of areas. So thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
And so the next thing will be, we do have another presentation from the department on loan forgiveness. And we're also going to focus on the loan forgiveness portion of the budget that the commissioner was just talking about. So today is loan forgiveness day in our committee. And we're going to hear this sort of general overview. And then we have several different proposals that we're going to be talking about. They're all going to be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. But they are all on a theme. So obviously, this is a huge year for recognizing and trying to take action on the workforce challenges that are facing the state. And loan forgiveness is perhaps one tool to do that. So this is under the Department of Health, and we're going to be doing that. And let's see, I'm not sure who is going to do the presentation, the initial overview. Who do we have here from MDH to do that?
So, Madam Chair, I'm Zora Bradasovich, Director of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care within the Department of Health. And Lisa, I think, is going to forward slides. Thank you for having me. So today I've been asked to give an update on some data that we have about our health care workforce, and then to talk about the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program that's administered within our office. Oh, next slide, Lisa, please. Our office surveys the healthcare workforce when the license providers, 19 professions, at the time that they renew their license. It includes all of the licensed healthcare providers. And the kind of data that we collect is demographic data, career and workforce, so things like their practice setting, hours that they work, their future plans. It can really give an insight into the workforce and our workforce needs. We ask about education, geographic distribution, and special collection. So like during the COVID time, we were able to pivot our survey and get a lot of information about what was happening on the ground in pretty much real time. Next slide, please. So this slide shows the shortages facing rural Minnesota and that they aren't new. Even after adjusting for population, rural Minnesota already has far fewer healthcare providers. Rural areas regularly have more than twice the number of people for every one provider. And among some professions, this gap is alarmingly large. Even before COVID, we were seeing the effects of this concern through long wait times to see providers, long distances to travel to access care, especially specialty care, seeing a shortage of beds and hospital and clinic service line closures. And then we added to that the stress in workforce and workload that these providers are already facing by serving twice as many people as their urban counterparts. And then, as you can see already, a shortage, our more recent data is showing that healthcare will likely lose even more workers within the next 5 years, particularly in rural areas. Next slide, please. So vacancies are a leading indicator of workforce shortages. Job vacancies have increased in nearly all health professions since their pre-pandemic levels. And in some cases, you can see that the increase has been dramatic. Largest increases have been in the mental health and substance abuse counseling occupations, where one in four jobs is currently vacant and open for hire, at an all-time high. In other areas where vacancy rates in 2021 were substantially higher than in 2019 include nursing, physical therapy, and respiratory therapy. And these data are really starting to quantify what we've been hearing more anecdotally, that healthcare employers are struggling to find the workers they need, and that COVID has exacerbated the situation. Next slide, please. So one of the questions that we ask on the workforce survey is about future plans of these workers. And survey results over the last year have shown an increase in those providers who report that they plan to leave the healthcare profession within 5 years. This has been one of the ways that we've been alerted to the growing need to build a replacement workforce for rural healthcare providers. Again, COVID has exacerbated that need. And as you can see in all professions except alcohol and drug counselors, the number who report planning to leave has grown over the last 2 years. Next slide, please. And then when providers do respond that they plan to leave the healthcare workforce or their positions, we follow up on the survey with more questions about why that is. And across all professions, we're seeing that the share of planned exits due to burnout or job dissatisfaction is higher. And it's, again, especially alarming in some professions like respiratory therapists and physician assistants. But we also know from the 2021 data that more providers are working in professions unrelated to their healthcare license when we compare it back even to 2019. And this does seem to indicate that burnout in their chosen profession may have been a factor. Next slide, please. So these likely losses in retirement and premature exit are especially alarming in rural areas. This workforce can't fully be replaced by the current level of new entrants into the workforce. So it's especially concerning among rural physicians who already tend to skew older than their urban counterparts. So you can see the share is greater across all of these professions. It's a complex problem. It's really one that was going to require, we believe, a multi-sector approach to solve. And it's one of the reasons that we're eager to do things like create rural training tracks for physicians and other primary care providers, because research does show that people do tend to work where they train, and we'd like to increase the number of those rural training sites in the state. But today I've been asked to talk especially about one approach that Minnesota is taking to address these expected losses in the healthcare workforce. That's the right slide. So one of the major ways Minnesota has chosen to address these shortages for the past many years is to invest in our healthcare workforce through loan forgiveness programs. They were authorized in statute to retain and recruit healthcare professionals to needed areas and to facilities within Minnesota. Loan forgiveness really is an important tool and a benefit for healthcare professionals, for the healthcare facilities that employ them, and for the communities that are experiencing shortages in access to primary care services. The eligible professions and practice locations are determined in statute. Next slide, please. So these are the professions that are currently eligible for the program. Minnesota's program generally focuses on building the provider base that serves rural and underserved urban Minnesotans. And we do it through a variety of designations, and I'll talk about them, but feel free to ask questions too. So we require service in a designated rural area or an underserved urban area for physicians, mental health professionals, and alcohol and drug counselors. Specifically in rural areas, we will provide support to pharmacists, dental therapists, and advanced dental therapists, and public health nurses. We also provide support for those working in rural areas or who teach in the nursing field, those mid-level practitioners and advanced practice providers. and also nurses who agree to practice in long-term care does not have the same limitation. And they are eligible if they agree to teach in the nursing field. And that has to be like at least 12 credits or 720 hours per year. Other healthcare technicians who agree to teach at that same level are also eligible for loan forgiveness through our program. And dentists who agree to deliver at least 25% of their yearly patient encounters to people in state programs or on sliding fee scale are eligible for loan forgiveness. Next slide, please. Our awards are based on average debt. We annually determine the average debt load by profession, and then the size of the award is determined using 15% of average debt that's in statute. And it can't exceed, the amount of the award can't exceed their actual debt load. There's a service requirement for most professions. It's a minimum of 3 years with an option to renew for a fourth year. And then the awards are given in annual payments of equal amount, roughly equal amount. Sometimes the last year might be a little bit less depending on what their award was. And we annually verify that they have continued eligible employment. And we also verify that the loan forgiveness funds were applied to their student loans. We also have a penalty and enforce the penalty that's in statute for non-fulfillment. And a person who doesn't fulfill their requirement is required to repay the entire amount that has been paid out to date plus interest. And we do make that clear to applicants when they're applying. Okay, next slide, please. This slide is showing the annual award over the last several years. In fiscal 20 and 21, we had the $3.4 million of the general loan forgiveness program. And this year we have $3.4 million from the general program. And also when you added $3 million for select professions last year, you can see the effect that we went from 75 awards made in fiscal 20 and 21, and this year are making about 138. I've also showed the number who have applied and the number who remain unfunded. And in dollar amounts, that's for this past year, for fiscal 22, we had over $22 million in requests and were able to fund about $6.9 million. Next slide, please. So I've also noted our urban and rural definitions. So for rural areas, we do require that it be outside of the 7-county metro area, but also we exclude those larger cities in outside of the metro area, the Twin City metro area, Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. And then we have urban underserved designations that go by health professional shortage areas or medically underserved areas. And this is one area where we are asking for a modification of that definition going forward. Last year, when you passed the increase in funding for the loan forgiveness program, you also allowed those funds to be used among providers who deliver at least 25% of their yearly encounters to state program enrollees or people on sliding fee schedules. And we have found over time that there are several clinics in the state that technically don't fall within a border geographically of a designated medically underserved area or a health professional shortage area, but their entire client base is drawn from an underserved population. And so we think a change like this would help make those people also eligible for loan forgiveness. Next slide, please. And I wanted to give you a little sense of overall retention of the program. It is a very effective program. The average percent retained, it varies by profession. You can see that rural physicians are at the highest. For physicians, when we look at 15 years, it's 74.7, almost 75%. When we get over 20 years, it's at 71%. Advanced practice, again, varies 70% at 15 years. It's dropped to about 60% by 20 years, but we are able to really retain health professions through this program. It's been very effective. And we're in the process of updating our retention study. These numbers are coming from a 2019 update that we had begun, but we don't have the numbers for all of the professions. Next slide, please. And then I also wanted to give a little sense of the effectiveness of loan forgiveness as a redistribution tool as well. We have more recent research that shows that loan forgiveness does work as a redistribution tool, that those who grew up rural and receive loan forgiveness are more likely to stay committed to the rural area that they serve when they do receive loan forgiveness. But also it showed that those who grow up urban, and the numbers are smaller, definitely, but those that had loan forgiveness to work in a rural area are many times more likely than their urban counterparts who did work in a rural area but didn't have loan forgiveness. So these are fairly recent findings, and we are interested in experimenting more with what we're finding there. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Radosevich. This is really great. And members, these slides will be sent out to you and will be posted. We didn't get them in time to get them in the initial packet, but that's very, very helpful. So thank you. And I'm sure that that does very much help frame the discussion we're going to have now, because we're going to, and Ms. Radosevich, if you can stay with us through the rest of the hearing, that'd be great, in case there are any questions that come up pertaining to any of these specific bills, because we're all working in that territory now. So the first bill that I have is Representative Freiberg. And Representative Freiberg, would you care to move House File 853 to be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, I will make that motion.
All right. And then Representative Freiberg moves that House File 853 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill, and that brings it before the committee. And then there's an A1 author's amendment. Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is just a technical amendment. I don't actually have it in front of me at the moment.
Okay. So did you want to move that then, Representative?
Yes, I will move the A1 amendment.
Okay. And to bring that before the committee. And then is there, let's see, maybe House Research, so whoever drafted it could tell us whether it's just confirmed, whether that's just technical, Ms. Clarkvist?
Madam Chair and members, Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research. Yep, the A1 amendment is a technical amendment. The sections that are being amended in House File 853 were amended in the 2021 legislative session. So this updates the statutes. So we're amending the right version of the statutes now in this bill.
All right, thank you, Ms. Clarkvist. So then let's adopt the technical amendment, if you would unmute yourselves. All in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Freiberg, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So acupuncture is something I don't have personal experience with, but I have a constituent who's kind of educated me about the issue. She's an acupuncture practitioner. And she's, you know, sent me numerous studies and so forth showing how effective acupuncture can be, particularly for treatment of pain, and can help reduce reliance on opioids. And there's just a host of benefits that are available to it. So I've introduced a couple bills related to the practice of acupuncture because of her. And this is one of them. So I appreciated the background you gave on the loan forgiveness program that we just heard. As we heard in that presentation, the loan forgiveness program has been very effective in getting medical providers into underserved areas. We saw kind of the list of some of the types of providers that are eligible for that includes medical or dental residents, licensed pharmacists, dental therapists, advanced dental therapists, mental health professionals, public health nurses, registered nurses. So this would just make a very simple change of adding acupuncture practitioners to that list of professions that is eligible for loan forgiveness. There are a couple testifiers here who are able to speak about it as well. So with that, I would be happy to turn it over to them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So first we have Amy Mager, if I'm saying it correctly. Welcome to the committee.
Major.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. And thank you, Ms. Radosevich, for the context that you created and the framework that you gave for why loan forgiveness matters in healthcare fields in rural areas and urban areas where professionals are reluctant to practice. Licensed acupuncturists have at least 60 hours of a bachelor's education or a bachelor's degree, right? I myself have a bachelor's and a doctorate. I am the vice chair of public policy of the American Society of Acupuncturists. I have been practicing in this field since 1990, and every provider, every acupuncture practitioner in Minnesota needs to go through a program from the ACAHM, which is the certifying organization for licensed acupuncturists. And they have a 25-hour program, plus clinical hours, plus taking 4 national psychometric exams in biomedicine, foundations of oriental medicine, herbal medicine, if practicing herbal medicine, and acupuncture in point location. CMS started covering acupuncture for Medicare for chronic low back pain in January of 2020. When CMS does that, we know that there is a strong evidence base as an evidence-based non-opioid treatment for pain. In my written testimony, which is lengthy, it gives specifics about where providers are practicing in Minnesota and how they are working with underserved patients, increasing access to evidence-based non-opioid treatments for pain as we are in an ongoing opioid crisis, and opiate deaths are unfortunately increasing as our addiction rates. And when we provide more non-opioid treatments for pain up front, we decrease opiates in circulation, ergo we decrease opiate addiction, both of which are things that we can help with as providers. Our education is on par and exceeds some of the professions that are currently covered. And when acupuncture practitioners in Minnesota are willing to do the work and serve populations that are currently underserved, we are asking respectfully, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that you consider including them to provide an integrative healthcare force to increase access for patients for the treatment of anxiety and pain. And please note, there's an NIH study, the Tick and Nielsen paper, which is the evidence-based non-opioid treatments for pain, which is linked in my written testimony. And I hope you will have the chance to have your staff review it because the evidence is profound. I thank you so much for your help and your time and consideration, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And if you have any questions, I am happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Major. Appreciate it. Chuck Sawyer, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer, and I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in support of House File 853 on behalf of acupuncture students at Northwestern Health Sciences University. I work there as a chiropractic doctor, and I previously served as our chief academic officer, so I'm very familiar with our program and the profession. Because of a growing body of scientific literature and clinical guideline reports, acupuncture has become one of the more important non-pharmacological therapies for the management of musculoskeletal pain, particularly in response to the opioid abuse epidemic. The scope of practice and the training of acupuncturists, it goes beyond pain, particularly musculoskeletal pain, especially back pain, but particularly in the case of musculoskeletal pain, it's very effective, and that literature is growing as we speak. However, like those in other professions, students from our university preparing to enter the workforce in a 10-trimester doctoral program commonly accumulate considerable debt student debt loan to cover the cost of their tuition. For example, at Northwestern, it's a little north of $76,000. And that's in addition to borrowing for living expenses, because this is pretty much a full-time program, books and other fees and so forth. And then after they leave our program, they have to often take out additional loans to start their own practice. Following graduation, the financial realities of their professional education often limits their practice options, frankly, to serving patients who have relatively good insurance coverage or who can afford to pay out of pocket for their care. Madam Chair and members, we support this legislation because it will provide a funding mechanism previously unavailable to acupuncture professionals that will make it more financially feasible for our graduates to practice in designated rural areas or underserved urban communities where access to acupuncture is currently limited and where there is also a high percentage of patients enrolled in state public insurance programs. Thank you, and please keep this in mind as you put together an omnibus bill. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sawyer. And so I think what we'll do is ask members to hold questions until the end, because we are running just a little bit behind, and I think we can hear all the bills and hear from all the testifiers and then have a few minutes for testimony. So Representative Freiberg, do you want to have a final word on this one before we lay it over?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you for your consideration and for hearing from the testifiers. And I encourage members to look favorably upon this legislation as we continue discussions in the session. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So House File 853, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So we will now turn to House File 1310, which is Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt, would you care to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill?
Madam Chair, I would.
All right, so moved. And then Representative Hewitt, I understand you also have an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that you need it to be in.
Madam Chair, I do. This amendment is very similar to Representative Freiberg's. It's a technical amendment. Feel free to call upon staff if you need explanation.
Okay, and this one is in the form of a DE, so it's the DE-1, but it's just a technical, and maybe I should ask, is this also Ms. Clarkvist? Ms. Clarkvist?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, this is a technical amendment. It provides that the appropriation for this bill is in fiscal year 2023 only, and not in fiscal year 2022, because that fiscal year will be almost over by the time this would be enacted. And it also corrects some cross-references to definitions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Clarkvist. So Representative Hewitt then is moving the DE-1 amendment. We'll just do a voice vote on that. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the DE-1 is adopted. So Representative Hewitt, to your bill as amended. And you are muted, Representative Hewitt.
I apologize, Madam Chair. This is a bill that already, a program that's already in existence. The bill would definitely bring funding back to it. This bill has, this program has been successful in serving our underlying areas in Minnesota, not just rural populations, but areas that are having trouble getting practitioners. The bill basically does loan forgiveness on both family practice physicians and on mid-level nurse practitioners and PAs. Today with me, Madam Chair, I have Dr. Oragu. I called your clinic to make sure that was right, so I would like her to speak on this if I could, Madam Chair.
All right, very good. Thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and with your own pronunciation. And go ahead with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sybil Oragu. I am a rural physician practicing in Long Prairie, Minnesota, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of the MAFP and the Minnesota Medical Association in strong support of House File 1310. While the COVID pandemic has created significant healthcare workforce shortages, we have seen a growing rural physician shortage coming for many years. According to the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, only 1 in 5 providers practice anywhere outside the urban areas of the Twin Cities, Rochester, Duluth, St. Cloud, or Moorhead. And combined with the fact that rural physicians tend to be older than those practicing in urban settings, we have a potential crisis brewing, especially as those physicians retire. When I joined my current practice, there were 5 physicians, one of whom had retired, but was only working as needed because of difficulty hiring a new physician to replace him. Since I started, one physician has left, another plans to leave in a few months, and the other 2 who have practiced in our community for decades plan to retire within the next 2 years. Recruitment has been a challenge for us on many fronts, and it's now made worse because of the pandemic. One successful solution to this provider shortage crisis is the use of loan forgiveness programs. These programs offset a portion of a physician's medical school debt if they agree to practice at least 3 years in a rural or underserved area. The University of Minnesota reports that the average debt for a medical school graduate is $200,000. Those with high debt are more likely to choose higher income specialties and are less likely to choose to practice in a rural or underserved area. It may be inevitable for medical students to have to take on debt to go to medical school, especially those from backgrounds that do not afford them with financial safety nets. Helping pay a portion of that debt through loan forgiveness programs serve an important role in ensuring that we meet our needs in rural Minnesota, and it works. I'm grateful for previous speakers who have talked to this program and how it works. And Minnesota has over 30 years of experience with physicians and other provider loan forgiveness. Over those 30 years, there have been nearly 1,140 recipients. And looking back over the last 10 years, the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care reports that about 67% of providers who have received loan forgiveness practice in rural areas versus only 17% of providers who have not. As importantly, majority of those recipients are still practicing in rural areas after the program is over. This compares to just 5% of all providers who practice in rural areas. The House File 1310 allocates an additional $1 million to Minnesota's loan forgiveness programs for family physicians, internists, OBGYNs, pediatricians, psychiatrists, or mid-level practitioners. These are the practitioners we critically need in rural areas. Will this funding solve the looming crisis? Not really, but it will help us recruit needed healthcare professionals to serve the patients in our area and our communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1310. I encourage you to approve this additional funding for a program that meets our rural health care needs.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Orugu. We appreciate your testimony today. Representative Hewitt, I don't think there's another testifier on your bill. Do you have any final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Orugu summarized it for me the way I was going to. So I think we can move on. Thank you very much for hearing the bill today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So House File 1310, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Next, we will take up House File 2715, Representative Edelson, who is not on our committee. So the chair will move that House File 2715 be before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Welcome, Representative Edelson. There is also an author's amendment on this bill, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's good to see you. I have an A1 amendment.
Okay. And Representative Edelson, is that also a technical?
Yes, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment has a technical word change, but it also removes Section 2 of the bill. It was interacting with federal law, and so we took it out for better clarity.
Okay, so the chair will move the A1 author's amendment. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Edelson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good to see you all. House File 2715, it expands existing home community-based services, the scholarship program, to allow funds to be distributed under this program to be used for loan repayment. with this, it's a pretty simple bill. It's an expansion bill. And I think you, Madam Chair, you said earlier in the committee that loan forgiveness is absolutely one way to address the workforce shortage. And I couldn't agree more. I have two testifiers here. And Madam Chair, I think it would be best to go to them right now.
All right. We can certainly do that. Thank you. All right. First on the list, we have Nicole Mattson. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members. If I could, it's the long-term care imperative that's testifying today. If Matt Steele could go first, we've kind of planned our testimony to be wisely using your time.
All right, very good. Happy to do that. Mr. Steele, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Steele. I'm the Director of Government Affairs with Leading Age Minnesota. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Nicole Mattson, from Care Providers of Minnesota, and together we represent both associations that make up the long-term care imperative. First, I would like to thank Representative Edelson for carrying this important bill. As you know, workforce is a critical issue for the long-term care profession. Providers in the senior care sector are experiencing high rates of employee vacancy, coupled with sustained high rates of turnover. There are 11,000 unfilled direct caregiver positions and close to 1,500 nurse positions in the home and community-based services space alone. Most of the key positions, such as nurses and direct caregivers, are over 20% unfilled. Turnover is also quite high as pandemic burnout and exhaustion have taken its toll on the workforce. The home and community-based scholarship grant program is one of few competitive advantages our sector has in the quest to recruit, retain, and develop talent for the long-term care profession. For example, with the challenges adult day programs faced during the pandemic being completely shut down, this program significantly helps rebuild their workforce. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I'm going to have my colleague Nicole Mattson discuss a bit more about the benefits of this proposal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Steele. Ms. Mattson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Nicole Mattson with Care Providers of Minnesota, and again, here today with the Long-Term Care Imperative. So like Representative Adelson said, the Home and Community-Based Services Employee Scholarship Grant is an existing competitive grant for licensed home cares, assisted living, or adult day programs that primarily serve people over the age of 65. Eligible organizations can apply through an RFP process managed by the Minnesota Department of Health each year, and organizations who apply then establish criteria by which the funds are disbursed for employee scholarships and hopefully loan forgiveness, we're going to add, and training expenditures in the courses of study that are expected to lead to career advancement within the field of long-term care. So this bill makes two small changes to that existing scholarship grant program, allowing for loan repayment for qualified educational debt and the ability to use these funds to pay for courses of study related to obtaining licensure as an assisted living director. So adding in the loan forgiveness is a crucial component to make this scholarship grant program work effectively for the broadest range of individuals. I really appreciate the conversation today and the value that everyone sees in loan forgiveness. So these are individuals who have acquired educational debt as a result of their healthcare education pathways, and access to loan forgiveness to provide significant financial value, but also offers an incentive to work in a home and community-based services setting. Furthermore, with the advent of assisted living licensure last year, the language allowing for courses of study related to management needed for a licensed assisted living director is a necessary component to make sure that this program can be effectively leveraged to meet the needs of the profession. In summary, the expansion of the HCBS scholarship grant program will allow providers greater flexibility to respond to the educational demands of its current and future workforce. The changes allow the program to adapt to meet these changing needs and help us improve this essential recruitment tool. And again, thank you to Representative Adelson and the committee for your attention to this issue.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mattson. And so, Representative Adelson, do you want to have the final word before we lay the bill over?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope to have the members support.
All right. Thank you very much for that. So, House File 2715, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I do hope the testifiers can stay also, because I think we will have some time for questions at the end here. So the next bill is, we are giving an informational hearing to, because we don't have possession of the bill, but it fits well in this category. So we thought it would be good for us to hear about the bill today. And that is House File 3418, Representative Vang. So welcome, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And go ahead and tell us about your bill if you would care to, or we can go to the testifiers to do that if you prefer.
Yes, thank you. I can give a brief about my bill, 3418. This is an important program that assists in recruiting and retaining mental health professionals in workforce shortage areas, both in rural areas and in specific neighborhoods and urban areas. Mental health professionals qualify for the program. This includes licensed psychologists, licensed independent clinic social workers, licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed professional clinic counselors, and licensed alcohol and drug counselors. Psychiatric nurse practitioners apply as advanced practice provider. In exchange for receiving funds, they must serve a minimum of 3 years and a maximum of 4 years. The annual repayment amount is $18,000 for psychologists, $9,300 for licensed social workers, licensed marriage and family therapists, clinical counselors, and alcohol and drug counselors. This program requires that participants provide at least 25% of annual patient encounters to state public program enrollees or patients receiving a sliding fee schedule, discounts through a formal sliding fee schedule. Providers serving a large number of Medicaid clients have less revenue than other providers and thus may have more difficulty in recruiting people to work for them. This is a competitive selection process. Preference is given to those closest to completing their training and to those who document diverse cultural competencies. The number of applicants that may be selected for participation varies annually and is contingent upon state funding. While most Minnesota is considered a workforce shortage area, it excludes the cities of Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. Participants are required to practice for at least 30 hours per week for at least 45 weeks per year for a minimum of 3 years. They must provide direct patient care hours or client-centered services and hours cannot be fulfilled, meeting with providers, process improvement, policy development, supervising, or administrating programs. This is one area that this bill tries to change. Perhaps because we do need more supervisors, we are changing this requirement and allowing mental health professionals agreeing to provide up to 768 hours per year of clinical supervision in their designated field to participate in this program. There are other important provisions in this bill, building on the successes of the last legislative session and continuing to address the severe shortage of mental health professionals. But this is what is in the bill relates to the loan forgiveness program. I also have a testifier here with me today to speak on behalf of this bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Vang. So on my list, I have first Sue Abderholden. Sue, welcome. I'm not seeing her. Is she here? Okay, I'm not seeing her or hearing her. So maybe we should go on to the second testifier and maybe she's having difficulty. Okay, so second testifier, Alma Marquez, Wilder Foundation, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the House and Health and Finance Committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Alma Marquez. I'm a mental health professional, a licensed independent clinical social worker, and I work as a child and family therapist and a supervisor for the Wilder Foundation. I'm here today to share my experience as a recipient of the Loan Forgiveness Program for Urban Mental Health Professionals. To understand the impact of this loan program, I think it might be helpful if I explain what the path to becoming a mental health professional was like for me and for many others. Grad school presented significant financial stress. Not only was school expensive, even with receiving several small scholarships, but the workload was so high with coursework, a thesis research paper, and an unpaid field placement internship with clients in severe mental health distress, that I was not able to continue working part-time. I had to take out loans for both school tuition and living expenses to complete my degree. Once I completed grad school, I was lucky to be offered a job immediately by the Wilder Foundation, where I had been interning, which was so helpful because right as soon as you graduate, your student loan payments begin immediately. As you are probably aware, the salary for a starting unlicensed mental health practitioner is low in a community mental health agency. Starting out as a practitioner was an extremely stressful time for me, balancing the stress of a new job, the trauma load of my clients, and the financial burden of my low salary, my high cost of living, and my student loan payments. I went into the mental health field wanting to work with children and families who are underserved and from diverse cultural communities. Growing up biculturally, I felt microaggressions, and I knew that a therapeutic space needed cultural safety to be effective. In a field dominated by primarily white female providers, I felt, and I still feel, that it is important for culturally diverse clients to have access to culturally diverse providers. Because of how stressful starting out as a mental health practitioner was, I thought about leaving community mental health for a higher paying position in the suburbs. I thought about leaving the field entirely. I looked for job postings online regularly. Ultimately, my love for my clients, the support of Wilder, and my personal commitment to working with diverse urban community prevented me from leaving, and I stayed on. After 2 years as a practitioner, getting regular board-approved supervision at my agency, I was able to sit for the exam and become a mental health professional. My salary increased a bit. However, again, I was tempted to leave community mental health because classmates I graduated with were also becoming professionals and leaving for private practice, taking only cash-paying clients and earning more than 2 times my salary. It was incredibly validating when I heard about the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program for urban mental health professionals. I applied immediately and I was awarded grants that paid off all of my student loans. The grants didn't make up for the difference between my salary and private practice, but they helped. And knowing that Minnesota legislators care about our urban communities having access to high-quality mental health professionals was very meaningful to me. Now, 12 years in the field, I'm supervising practitioners fresh out of grad school towards their licensure as mental health professionals. Their struggles are so similar to my story. I work in a program serving kids and families of diverse cultural communities. We try very hard to recruit mental health providers of color in community mental health. I meet extremely talented providers of color in interviews who feel passionate about providing therapy in urban and diverse cultural communities, but we cannot match the salaries of agencies or private practices that don't accept medical assistance and only take cash payments. And many of these talented new therapists can't afford the cost of working for passion and purpose. One of my interns, who was really promising talent, decided to leave the field entirely after graduating because she earned more as a waitress than she could as a mental health practitioner. And she had to prioritize her family's needs above her passion. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the Health and Finance Committee for allowing me to share today and for looking for ways to keep high quality mental health, diverse professionals accessible to our community through programs like loan forgiveness. I am happy to answer any questions you may have now or at a later time. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your testimony and thank you for working in that field. So important. Ms. Abderholden, I know you've had some internet issues. Thank you for hanging in there and getting on with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I apologize. My internet went out and then my laptop crashed. So I'm on my cell phone, so I hope that this works. I think as everyone knows, we are in the midst of a pretty severe mental health workforce crisis. There simply aren't enough people to do the needed work, and we don't have a diverse workforce. While there are several strategies to address this, some were passed last year, we know that the loan forgiveness program is effective in helping mental health professionals stay in the field and take positions in clinics that serve a higher percentage of clients on Medicaid or from diverse communities. The Department of Health conducted a survey and found that 73.4% of psychiatrists, 88.3% of mental health clinicians, and 86% of licensed alcohol and drug counselors were white. Clearly, our mental health workforce does not represent the people of our state. One data piece that is hopeful is that our BIPOC mental health professionals and LEDCs are slightly more diverse for the ones who are younger. The loan forgiveness program was amended back in 2015 to include all mental health professionals. And since 2016, the program has had 133 mental health professionals participate in the program. 92 were from rural areas and 41 in urban underserved areas. During the last legislative session, LEDCs were added to this program. In sum, it's a really good program, and increasing funding will at least somewhat help address at least one pain point in this crisis. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Abderholden. Appreciate that. And so the bill is not actually before us, but because we don't have possession of it, so we will close the informational hearing on House File 3418. And then we haven't taken questions on any of the bills yet or for Ms. Radosevich from the Department of Health. So we do have some time if members do have questions. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the last bill that we're looking at, I did have a question for Ms. Marquez on the trainees that she's instructing. And I'm just wondering, she mentioned so many don't stay in service, and I'm just wondering if she could give us an estimate of what that percentage is. Is it 50% that stick around, or is it fewer than that?
Okay, we can ask. I don't know if she would have that kind of data, but no, she's shaking her head. But maybe Ms. Radosevich, I don't know if that's the sort of data that you would have. Can you answer that at all? I don't know if you need the question repeated.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have information that comes close to that, but I don't have it at my fingertips. We could get that for you and let you know.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just another question. Maybe it's to be determined later. I'm just wondering, you know, as we look at these industries, the one testifier talked about direct care professionals that we need 1,100 or 1,500. How many mental health care providers do we need that we're missing? We're obviously in the midst of a mental health crisis. We all talk about it. We all hear about it. But how many do we need to fill those slots? Maybe Ms. Abderholden could help.
Okay, let's ask Ms. Abderholden, and then maybe Ms. Radosevich has that as well. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Radosevich might have a better number, but I can tell you that a lot of mental health providers right now have tons of open positions, so much so that in our residential treatment facilities, they are serving usually half the number that they would have served because of the lack of providers. We do know as well that about half of the people who graduate from programs don't go on to become licensed. So that becomes another stumbling block in terms of expanding our field.
And Ms. Radosevich, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, I don't have a number, but we do know that the vacancy rates, I believe, were like 1 in 4 openings. So we can confirm those numbers, but the actual vacancies that people are trying to fill in those fields are great.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Representative Bierman. Okay. Representative Pryor.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a general question, which I think probably would go to Ms. Radotovich again, which is we're talking about student loan forgiveness for going to certain, living in certain areas, serving a certain population. But if we're talking about this loan forgiveness, it's kind of like at the very end of the whole process of earning these degrees, getting this kind of training, being able to qualify to fill these roles. So it's like all of that is done. And then we're saying we're trying to choose where to divert these new graduates and these people that have just attained these degrees or we're trying to recruit them from other areas with this incentive of loan forgiveness. So my question is, when we're trying to influence them, people to go into certain, to live in and choose certain roles or jobs to take, do we also know what they're turning down? And so are we just kind of choosing areas in the state, end up choosing areas in the state where now we say these are the winners for it, and these other places are going to, you know, it means that they're not doing something else instead, where those people say, well, gosh, you took our new hire away because this was a better job. So I guess it's more like, you know, at a higher level, what we're doing when we're choosing this route of recruiting people to certain areas that are underserved.
So great question. So Ms. Radosovic, are we cannibalizing each other with these kinds of programs, or do you have any insight for us?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't say that, and I wouldn't be able to give you exactly where people are coming from, but I do know that it is an issue that we need to be addressing across the entire pipeline of health providers. So encouraging people, you know, to join those fields or to become educated in those fields, drawing people from areas where they want to go back and serve, and helping make that better. I think we can address, like I said, the issue across the pipeline.
Representative Pryor? Okay, thank you. And just to follow on that, Ms. Radosovic, when people go into the field, are they aware of these programs as they're taking on the debt, or is it only afterwards that they become aware that this is out there?
Madam Chair, we do a fair amount of outreach, and our staff that work on loan forgiveness speak with students and classes, you know, all the time. They do it every year, and we try to expand that outreach so that people are aware that those programs exist.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I really appreciate the conversation about mental health and underserved areas. As many of you know, I come from an area that a lot of times family have to transport somebody that needs mental health problems for miles or into the cities, which is a good 5-hour drive if they can find someplace for help. Now, we have the wonderful Susan would be able to tell us about Northwest Mental Health Center that's come into Aluma, I can never pronounce its new name, Aluma, and we've lost some certain care, but we really lack a lot of mental health professionals in general because of the remote area, and I'm sure it's challenging, and I can appreciate the cities too. And I'm supportive of this program. I am concerned about the even what Representative Pryor said about making sure that we're not drawing from other areas. However, I'm finding it really interesting in conversations with medical professionals, whether it's an internist or whatever we're seeking. I asked one who came from a major city, why did you come to rural Minnesota? What made you come? I mean, guys, right now we're hardly moving because of the snowstorms that keep happening. And he said he really liked the individual family connection that he could provide, that the patient he knew right away if they were doing well or they needed something they weren't telling him because of the relationship once again. So my concern is that we make it so difficult to help with loan forgiveness that we prioritize certain ethnic groups or with certain areas I think are important because we need to make sure we deal with underserved, but would want to be careful of how tight we make it, because I think, you know, as well as making sure as that students know that these are opportunities that are available for loan forgiveness, it is also important that they look for places that they want to blossom their career. And I too am the kind of person who hopes they get the loan forgiveness. 4 or 5 years down the road, they say, you know what? I've already developed a family, a life in this area, and I've planned to stay, because that becomes part of the problem. And I know burnout is definitely something to be concerned about, because when you don't have enough nurses, doctors, mental health professionals, they eventually say, I can't do this anymore. So it just gets so insurmountable. So I would, Madam Chair, Representative Vang, I certainly am supportive of it. However, I want us to be careful how we do this so that we are not shooting ourselves in the foot. I'd even like to see our colleges, our higher ed universities start to tell, you know, maybe they can see ways to reduce some of the cost of education so that we can get this field moving, and that students see the possibility of being in those fields too becomes a real important item. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vang, did you want to respond? You turned on your camera. I thought maybe that meant you had something to say. No.
No, Madam Chair. And Representative Keel, thank you so much for your comments. And I look forward to moving forward. And if there's anything that we can improve on this language, I'm open to that. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask a question on acupuncture. Ms. Major, if she's available.
Okay.
Just wanted to find out, what are the most common conditions that acupuncture is used for relief? I know there was a lot of talk about pain and opioid use, reducing opioid use with acupuncture treatment. So I'm just curious what other ailments are relieved. And then a second question, I think I heard that CMS covers acupuncture for lower back pain as of 2020. My question was, does CMS have other restrictions on the use of acupuncture, or is all acupuncture covered by CMS?
Ms. Major, are you still on with us?
I'm not seeing her, but I do see Dr. Sawyer turned his camera on.
Okay, and I know that also Bonnie Bolash was available. Dr. Sawyer, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'll take part of the second question, I guess, and that's CMS. announcement is a little complicated because it covers acupuncturists or professionals who are trained as acupuncturists to provide care to Medicare beneficiaries only if they're under the supervision as, quote, ancillary providers. That's a pretty deep in the weeds thing to kind of grasp. But it's a good step forward because of the substantial literature confirming the value of acupuncture, but it still doesn't fully open up access to acupuncture the way we'd like. And to your first question, and I don't have it right in front of me, but a few years ago, our Department of Human Services substantially increased or expanded the number of conditions or the list of conditions that acupuncture would be eligible for reimbursement when provided to Medicaid, medical assistance of Minnesota care patients. Originally, it was back pain only, and only if it was chronic for, I believe, 90 days or something like that. But now it's any musculoskeletal pain, back pain especially, you know, from the very first date of onset, plus anxiety, insomnia, and a whole host of other conditions. So the point of that is that decision by DHS was also based on some very, very substantial review of the literature. And I was there for a few of the meetings of the committee that advises DHS. And even I was amazed at the amount of clinical trial and other literature that supported acupuncture as a very effective therapy.
All right. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
One more question just for Dr. Sawyer. Just wondering what a typical visit for an acupuncture treatment entails. I mean, is it 6 visits or 12 visits or 1 visit?
Mr. Sawyer?
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative. It will depend on the condition, as I understand it. Not as familiar, at least at that measure of detail, with the profession. But it will depend on the condition and when the patient presents to an acupuncturist. But in general, the procedure, the therapy would be provided over a course of several visits and possibly several weeks, depending on the chronicity, the location of the pain, and so forth. Now, with that said, There are other measures or other therapies that acupuncturists provide, including instruction to patients regarding what they can do on their own for home exercises and other things that they can do to help speed up the recovery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So I have a question on the Edelson bill, and I don't know if maybe one of our two testifiers could speak to. This bill is a little different than the others we heard today in that I think, as I understand it, some of these benefits are provided through employers. And I wonder if, Ms. Mattson, if you could just sort of explain how this is different and similar to the other bills, which are all just through the states. It's where an individual goes and applies. And could you just kind of make clear how yours is positioned a little differently?
Sure. So the existing HCBS employee scholarship grant, there's eligibility for Minnesota-based employers who serve individuals over the age of 65 and have their existing in-house employee scholarship program or are planning on developing one. And to be eligible as a recipient, so this the employer would receive the grant, but then the employer is telling the health department, this is how we intend on spending the funds. And to be eligible for a scholarship, the recipient has to be employed in a caregiving role and must work at least 16 hours per week. And they can use the grant funds for courses of study related to like health trainings or scholarships for degree programs that are relative to patient or client care, like social work or degree programs for serving people with disabilities or gerontology, occupational therapy, physical therapy, et cetera. So there's a lot of different avenues in which the money could be used, but it is the employer telling MDH how they intend on using the grant funds at the time that they make that application, at the time that they fill out that RFP, which I think just concluded at the end of last month. And I know Zora is here as well, and she could probably answer some questions, but it is an existing program and has been used very successfully by members in the home and community-based services space.
So Ms. Mattson, this functions more like a benefit of employment for those employees and is there a requirement for the employee to continue working with the employer for a period of time or anything like that?
Well, I don't think you can require at the point in time that the grant funds are distributed, the individual has to be averaging 16 hours per week. There's not a requirement to say now you must continue working here. The requirement is retrospective and not prospective, if that makes sense.
Okay, so it sounds like it more functions as a something to attract employees, and not to mention giving them a leg up into a higher level of.
I think attracting employees, but Madam Chair, also serving as a means to grow the senior care workforce and to kind of earn and learn. I think that's a key component of success, having the opportunity to both obtain your a degree in healthcare, but also an opportunity to experience what it's like to have connections with other healthcare workers and with residents.
Sure, absolutely. All right, thank you. Representative Keel, we have two minutes. Go for it.
Oh, I'll get my vote. Sorry. I would ask this question as a thought provocative. And a home and based community, I've often thought, wouldn't it be nice if we had people that were thinking about medical professions to be on that basis of just helping care for somebody who goes home, needs help, whether it's aged, disability, or whatever. It really gives us a taste of what is needed. And I think that's what helps us to fund that job also, is to encourage people to go into it. But it is a very highly observative job. You have to be reading all the tea leaves when you're helping somebody. And I think
in that it's a great program. I'd like to know more about how we do it. And thank you, Madam Chair, for letting us
know. All right. Thank you, Representative Keel. All right, members, we've reached the end of our hearing. Thank you to all the members who brought bills and to all of the testifiers today. It's been very interesting and informative. I just want to say to everyone, if you didn't have a bill in this, if you have a bill in this general bucket and it didn't get heard today, that does not in any way mean that it can't be considered. We're going to, I hope, be doing something, you know, to bring all of this together. And really, we're going to be doing obviously a lot on workforce this year. So thank you all for your interest in this topic. And the next meeting is tomorrow. We're going to be talking about some bed moratorium exception bills. So with that, members, thank you very much. We are adjourned.